Okay. Thank you, Anton, for the invitation and the introduction. I'll tell you a story about almost biology today. And I'm going to, since I've been surviving all day outside with this jacket on, it must be rather a warm jacket, so I have to shed layers. Okay, so there are a lot of names listed on here, and there's some organization to this. These two, a former graduate student who, the second part of my talk will be more on his work, a current graduate student who basically devised the instrumentation and the image analysis work for most of what I'll tell you in the first sort of half of the talk, for half to two-thirds, and then a row of three postdocs. And it's a little hard to read with this background. They're jointly mentored, and so my colleague Aaron Dinner and I, Aaron is a theorist and simulator, really have a very close collaboration and share the responsibilities and the burdens of working with these very talented people. So for the most part, Sri and Charlie have worked together on the experiments I'll tell you about. I'm also not a biologist, and so we have a great biology collaborator, Sean Crossan, who's in our biochemistry and molecular biology department. And on some aspect of the work dealing with the theoretical modeling of some things I'll tell you about, we've also collaborated with Gavin Crooks. Okay, so I cut out a lot of slides on abstract motivations, and I'm going to start from maybe a question about determinism versus stochasticity and whether this can also be considered in a biological system, a living system, and that to me is quite important. That is not just on single molecules that perhaps are driven out of equilibrium in some way, but something that intrinsically functions and is organized to function in an equilibrium fashion. Okay, so we're, at least the ones of us who have gray hairs, know about these devices that are old-time watches or clocks. And these are intricately designed machines where every piece of the mechanism functions together as one unit. It has a deterministic output, which is to give us some metric of the progression of time. But in a biological system, who's to say that there is literally one master clock and one process that drives everything? that although these are, of course, is not the best rendition, these are all time-related clocks. And so they have a synchronization to them, but it at least gets us to the next step of thinking about there are various processes, or we might even think of them as functional modules that constitute the output of the cell. And some of these might be DNA replication, and some of these might have to do with cell division, for example, to name two. All right, but layered on top of that, and I don't know how this is not the best example for stochasticity, but there is this marvelously difficult book by Yossi Klafter, termed First Steps in Random Walks, and this is at least one way to think about, from a, let's say, a time trajectory standpoint, random processes and random processes that are well beyond just simple sort of Gaussian statistic behaviors. Ultimately, this plays a role in the system I'll talk about today, but I probably won't really get that far. Okay, so the organism I'm going to be talking about throughout is a bacterium. This is I forgot to add the label. This is from the Yves-Brun group, and it's an electron microscopy image of the organism. Colobacter crescentis, and one of the reasons that people are interested in this organism is that you can see deterministically the asymmetry between what is becoming the daughter cell and a flagellum, and what is the, I'll term it the mother cell, or ST for stalked cell. That is, it has a stalk and it generates a holdfast. that is a super glue, a polysaccharide in this case, that can attach itself onto surfaces. This lives in freshwater ponds, for example, as a natural habitat. Okay, and the process, as Anton briefly alluded to, that I'll be telling you various stories about today is that of a sort of top-down studies that is not molecularly bottom-up studies of the cell cycle. So in the cell cycle portion of it that I'm going to talk about is not so much the developmental phase going from the daughter turned swarmer, which can swim around, but rather it'll be this piece of it, which is from the, what I termed a moment ago, a mother cell or a stalked cell that's held onto a surface, basically the development of the swarmer into the stalk. The stalk will then grow. It grows asymmetrically, as I just said a moment ago. Eventually, there's a division that occurs and then complete separation of the mother and daughter, and the daughter can swim away. The organisms live in nutrient sort of starved environments, and so this is a way to help their survival in the environment, is that one doesn't want to have colony formation or crowding occurring in these starved environments, because most of the cells will then not get any nutrients whatsoever. So the daughters are meant to swim off to some other location and then attach and then recover this. So in particular, what we're going to be looking at in all of the experiments are only the behaviors of these stalked or mother cells. So even though in some of the experiments there may be some daughter cells produced that will stick in the field of view, those are never included in the data. Okay, another aspect of what will be important for the second half of the talk is the fact that there are certain proteins, and I'll just give you one alphabet soup name here, CTRA, which is termed a master regulator. And within this, what I just defined as my cell cycle, that is from stalked to basically stalked, I should have extended the scale here a bit, it undergoes one cycle of increase in concentration and then rapid fall off of the concentration. This is thought to be, in the literature, basically a kind of a clock that ends up synchronizing many other processes, and I'll talk about that in some detail. Okay, so one perspective on learning about this organism might be, let's say, to go through, as Lucy Shapiro and Harley McAdams at Stanford have done, and John Tyson at UVA, or Virginia Tech, sorry, have done, which is to construct detailed, molecularly detailed biochemical reaction networks. And these are, you can think of these as circuits. The arrows mean that one of these proteins is increasing the activity or the expression of another, and these bar-like features are meant to be repression. That is, this DivK species here, to name an alphabet name again, can act to inhibit this particular chemical reaction step. Okay, the CTRA is way down here, but nevertheless, as I'll show later, it is thought to be, you know, obligate, and certainly by these authors is thought to be the key to the entire regulation of the cell cycle. The little bit of color coding that's on here is this is all associated with how to create those increase and decrease behaviors in CTRA concentration, and then it in turn feeds into the process of division. Seems very deterministic. Okay, so how do we think about this? Well, on the lower right-hand side, well, perhaps we can think about this in analogy with electrical circuits. And I'm actually going to take that perspective, especially in the second half, which is, well, you know, how do I learn about this circuit? Well, I can do this, and that's a bit drastic, and maybe that's not the best way. That tells me the list of parts, but not much about how they actually function. And, you know, maybe I can be a little bit more subtle, ring the bell, and if it resonates, then I've learned something. So the basic idea, again, the second part will be that of, if you will, spectroscopy, perturbation, and response, and we'll measure response functions. In this community, they're also sometimes called phase resetting curves. Okay, so this is the last slide that's sort of introductory, but more towards the second part, which is to create these pulsatile perturbations onto the system. We can outline those as the idea of an external oscillator. Somehow we have to create an interaction so that these external chemical perturbations, they're not optical at all, this is all chemical, will interact with the internal oscillator that is a cell process of growing and dividing. And you can really think of this as, although it's not a circadian system, it is very much like our circadian clocks. That is, we are more or less synchronized to the 24-hour cycle of the sun. And then what I illuminated from here are many biological processes that you and I undergo every day that are controlled and regulated by this. Okay, so... So let me start here. So as a disclaimer, I'm going to say I didn't read this paper until after everything I'm going to talk about in the first half, so that's poor scholarship. And then what I discover is that, well, this guy, Jacques Monod, a true genius, had basically thought about everything that we have now done, except, of course, he couldn't do it. So anyway. So he was very interested in, and the issue that he won his Nobel Prize on is basically the questions having to do with the growth of bacteria. And his studies were all at the level of populations, but nevertheless, there were very clear features that he elucidated. So I suggest, you know, read this article as opposed to try to read everything now. as an outline, what I'm going to tell you about in the first part of the talk is very simple-minded questions. What is the growth law for these single-cell organisms? I'll tell you a little bit about the challenges associated with determining that growth law. And now I realize I forgot to add one slide, but I can do that on the blackboard. What is the temperature dependence of that? And then what are some of the consequences that fall out? And then can we devise a model that explains all this? So from a chemical kinetic standpoint, it turns out it's not at all what I would have thought. So indeed, if we read this paper and one in 1952, that was all we needed to know, and the rest is all math and measurement. Okay, so here's the idea. So one of the things that you certainly know about bacterial growth is that at the level of a population that the growth behavior is exponential. It's a geometric growth, 2 to 4 to 8, 16, et cetera. And what we had to deal with in our experiment, especially since what we want to look at and do measurements of, are the same identical cells for many generations. In our case, we can do experiments for more than 100 generations for any given cell. So 2 to the 100th power is a very large number. It will be more than what we can possibly fit into our array detector and measure, and apart from clogging up the entire microfluidic apparatus. So this is the normal behavior of this organism. This is obviously a time-lapse movie. And what you see happening is that there were growth and division epochs. And some fraction of the daughter cells, not all of them, a small fraction of them decided to stick onto the glass surface in our microfluidic flow apparatus. This is just spontaneous adhesion. You can call it a sticking coefficient if you like surface science. The probability for adhering was less than 1, but more than 0. So the first thing that we needed to address is, and excuse the molecular biology sort of nomenclature, is we needed to control two things. So for the second part of the talk, what we're going to be controlling is this protein CTRA that I labeled already. This is the gene of it. We put it onto a little construct called a plasmid, and then we put it under protein regulation via an inducible promoter via the small molecule xylose. They're basically going to flow xylose into the system, and that will allow us to then to control the expression of this. So we knocked it out of the chromosome. For this question about the crowding on the surface, there is another gene which basically creates this polysaccharide superglue. So if we can controllably turn that on and off when we want, then we can stick an initial population of cells onto a surface, and then we basically turn it off by removing this small molecule, which is again, this is the gene. There's a small molecule, is vanillite. It's basically like vanilla. We can flow that in and turn on and off this gene, and hence the superglue. And the result of that is, you can see, there's essentially no spontaneous adhesion. So now we have the possibility of going and doing experiments on every single one of these cells for, as I said, we've gone probably 200 generations in the max case so far, and that in this case takes of order 2 weeks, continuous measurement. Okay, so a little bit detail on the measurement. We want to do a little bit of multiplexing, and that basically means, this is just an example of the particular locations that we used in a microfluidic flow channel, and there are either 20 or 25 individual squares here. These are literally the fields of view on the array that's imaged onto the array detector, and we can raster this entire stage on an inverted microscope. And we'll do this rastering and do the imaging once every minute. So we take 20 or 25 of these snapshots. Okay, so let's see. So this is sort of the same kind of data. This is then that stream of the 20 or 25 regions of interest. And now, so here's a little bit of math. One frame per minute of each of these positions, of order 30 cells per position. We don't want them to be overly crowded. And this translates into 1 million unique cell images per day. Okay, so even though my graduate student, Charlie, works very hard, there is no chance that even in his lifetime he would be able to really analyze these by hand. All right, so he was very clever, and he developed a pixel interpolation, basically now a spline interpolation approach to determine cell contours in this phase microscopy. It's a very simple microscopy method. And the contrast is good enough so we know what is the cell, what is inside the contour, and what is outside the contour. And so we can determine the area of the cell with approximately 1 to 2% precision per cell, per image. Okay. Let's see if this advances. All right, so there's a little bit of an issue of image analysis, and I'm really not going to dwell on this much further, but there are several steps having to do with creating kind of a binary image from what is determined as being inside and outside, and then we simply, you know, determine area from that. So this is actually the, if you will, the time trajectory associated with a few cells in this field of view. And again, you can see that each one of the cells has a little bit of an independent behavior. But over time, it grows in size, divides, shrinks in size, grows, divides, shrinks. Okay, so the first question, as I said, is what is the growth law? So this is the behavior of one of these cells. This is a log scale on the vertical axis, and this is time in the horizontal. And just these are actual contours of the cell itself, and you can see that it grows, and that at some point, and I'll usually be using the variable tau. So A here is area, tau is the division time, and T is a lab time in the experiment. Okay, so it looks, you know, to all reasonable people except the reviewers of our paper, this looked pretty linear on a semi-log plot. Okay, but you know, the criteria are usually more stringent, and really I had to learn about, you know, the reasonableness of deducing whether the growth is exponential or linear. It's not just good enough to look at it and maybe even determine an average of this and do some fitting. We really went into this issue in a serious way, as challenged by the reviewers, to say that, you know, how precisely can we determine all this? Okay, so I'm just going to, it's a little bit dim, but you can see the contour here in red, and I'm just going to say our precision on a single cell determination level, this was at one instant of it, of its growth behavior, is 1 to 2%. And now what we're going to do is measure something of order 10,000 of these cells under a given environmental condition, 10,000 of these growth curves. So each growth curve is of order 100 points, and that gets us into this range of a million individual images. Okay, a lot of data. And I'll illustrate something on the board in 1 second. So what we see below, what we see on the right-hand side is just the results from 20 cells, 20 growth curves. They all look kind of similar. They have initial values that are ranging all over the place, but you can see that they're fairly parallel to each other. If we follow the time trajectory of just a part of the time trajectory of one of these cells, we see that it has some variation also in its size over time. That's kind of a higher order issue that I am not really going to talk about today. But more or less it behaves always with the same growth law. So I can already draw one conclusion, whether this is exponential or not, that they're all growing approximately at the same rate throughout this entire epoch. And when we do this for 100 or 200 generations, which is now somewhere over here, then the growth law persists. So these cells are immortal. In the literature for this exact organism, there is and you can look on Wikipedia, just look at Colobacter crescentis, and there will be two papers listed that say the cell ages. No, it does not. That experiment had problems, but nevertheless, it's on Wikipedia, so at the moment, we're going to have to knock it off from there. Okay, that will take a little bit of time. All right, so now the question about the growth law and the question about precision. So if I have, and I'm going to now talk about this not at the individual growth curve level, but at the level of the mean. So I can either have, let's say, linear growth. And that means if the actual growth behavior is exponential, and I have to set one criterion that I haven't explained yet, but I'll prove it in a second, that the cell size grows to 1.8 times its initial one, then the max deviation under these conditions between the linear and exponential function is 4%. So at the level of the mean, So I don't know how to do square roots very well. So let me say the precision we want is 1%. And let's say the noise is Poisson. So I want one part out of 100 precision. That means I need 10,000 growth curves, and hence this number 10,000 that I threw out a little bit glibly before. That is, if we want to know that this is with absolute precision, that this is exponential growth law, then we'll measure 10,000 growth curves. We did that. Okay, so... So I didn't think about it since I'm talking to a physics audience, how many sigma precision are we talking about, but it's at least 5 sigma. It's really good. Maybe it's 7 sigma. Okay, this is at PNAS now, not Nature Revised, sorry. This is the reviewers couldn't get past this plot. Okay, so the issue here is, what we want to look at, it's buried a little bit at the bottom, but, it's very simple. So if we have an exponential function, we have a rate constant, we have some time variable, and then we have some relationship between the initial size and the final size. So we have an initial condition and growth. And let's make this a little more strict, because I said that I rounded it off 1.88. Here it's 1.77. But the cell is known, it was known from ensemble measurements, to divide at approximately this ratio. And so we can actually test that very deterministically by looking at the cell size at the beginning and at the time tau when it divides. And we see that all the data superimpose from, I didn't say these are all at different temperatures. They all superimpose, and they all follow, again, I'm not fitting it 5 times, but they all follow with 0.99 correlation coefficient the same linear regression. Okay, so I don't want to berate this point about statistics, but, we have ample statistics to answer these kinds of questions. So what did we do over here? What I didn't emphasize is that the colors that are supposed to show up here, there are 5 different clouds of points. Each one is between 5,000 and 18,000 data points, are representing the growth law and the size behavior at different temperatures. So, and this is sort of amazing, is, you know, over, this is the entire physiological range of the organism, and they all follow the same trend, exactly. So, of course, that means, since I am a chemist, I have to immediately think about Arrhenius. And so we can now regress to the mean, and the same color coding is obtained here. We've also done this for other medium conditions, that is, different nutrient resources in the environment, and what we get are lines with the same slope, but just intercepts that are offset. But nevertheless, this is a pretty good Arrhenius plot. Again, the reviewers wanted us to somehow extrapolate this, and then it will look like a better line. I don't know what on earth that meant. But this is what you get at Nature these days, is, you know. Okay, so, you know, I take this as an Arrhenius behavior, and so, again, kind of simple idea. And I can extract the activation energy. And so I thought for sure what's going to happen is that Arrhenius behavior, I'm kind of brainwashed as a chemist to think about mechanisms of rate-limiting step. And then I come up with this, we came up with this number, 12.6 kcal per mole. Okay, kcals in this audience doesn't mean anything. But let me just say, this is the canonical generic value for the activation energy for any single enzyme-catalyzed reaction. You take your pick. This is the mean of some range. So I don't have a big number. I don't have a rate-limiting step mechanism. I amazingly ended up with this rather run-of-the-mill result. And so all of a sudden, I don't know how to think about how do I get a single rate constant. I showed you a piece of a network before. There are already at least 30 reactions on what I showed you a few slides ago. I can't even conceive of what is the step that is limiting, because here this is a canonical average. It doesn't help me whatsoever. Okay, so I'll come back to what's on the right-hand side in a moment. So we basically had to throw out the idea of rate-limiting step, and then this is, as I said, the second paper I had to read, which was by someone named Hinchelwood, who was very famous in gas kinetics. And he wrote down this in a not well-cited paper, but it should be, this idea of, well, what if I have a cycle, and I treat this as an autocatalytic process, that is, the steps in the reaction mechanism are just shown here, so X1 begets more of X1, and X2 begets more of X2. But the rate at which this is occurring is dependent upon the X sub N, or here X sub 1, that is the previous step, begets the rate for the next step. And we tie all this together as a cycle. So what Hinchelwood showed in 1952 at the level of just deterministic differential equations is that what he gets from this, no matter, so long as the cycle is running at steady state, is a geometric mean of all the individual rate constants for all the individual N steps. Ah, so that means, you know, I have a rate constant. I can get Arrhenius behavior from this. Okay, so maybe there are other ways of doing it, but at least this is something that we are happy with, and we can use it really to test our insights. So the way to test is, as I said, that we have an abundance of data, not just at the level of the mean. We can look at the level of the distributions. And so you don't need to bother to memorize this. This is the, if you will, in a very cryptic notation, the master equation equivalent to the deterministic differential equation mechanism by Hinchelwood. And so now, in principle, we can solve a master equation. But of course, it turns out this doesn't have a general solution. So my postdoc, Sri, did this as a method of moments, and so we solved for the first two moments. Of course, the first moment ought to be the same as the mean, by definition, and the second moment is going to give us information about distributions. Okay, so also the solution that she has for what I'll talk about right now is at the level of steady state. But I'll show you more about that later. Okay, so now I can come back to the other plot that I glossed over a moment ago, which is, I'm sorry, the colors are a little bit hard to define here, but this is basically showing a distribution of the variable as a division time, scaled by the mean value of the division time, as a function of the same scaled parameters, division time over the mean. And we see a scaling collapse. So all the data that were obtained at different temperatures are completely superimposable. From the master equation treatment, and this method of solution at the second moment, we were also, and one other criterion, that is that the division occurs at a relative size threshold, that is when the cell gets to 1.8 times its initial size, those criteria, then is enough for to allow us to solve explicitly for what is the functional form associated with this distribution from this Hinshelwood, or we call it stochastic Hinshelwood model. And that's shown here as a dashed curve. There are no parameters. So this is a beta exponential distribution. I didn't do any fitting here. I obtained the parameters from our experimental data and simply plugged them in. So there's no adjusting of any parameters, and it nails these scale distributions completely. So this is a pretty strong suggestion that we're on track with respect to this idea of the Hinshelwood, at least at steady state, and these autocatalytic cycles as being operationally useful. Another prediction comes as to how should the size of the cell change over time. And these are basically, this is now a little bit different representation. These are at all the different temperatures, again, the color coding, but now at different time points along the growth process. And unfortunately, it's a little bit hard for you to, you'll have to believe me, that these are all superimposable. So again, there's something interesting about how the cell size and the distribution of cell sizes evolves over time, and it's constrained. So this is a prediction that's being made by the Hinshelwood model. I'm just not showing the functional form inside of here just to avoid more confusion. But nevertheless, the prediction is met by the experiment. Okay, so I got a little bit ahead of myself, and let me come back to this point. So one of the things to remember is that what we have is growth. Basically, we're taking the area of the cells as a surrogate for the size, versus lab time, and at this point for this representation, once the cell has gotten to this threshold value, this is when it divides. Of course, there's now a dispersion in time, and there is, you know, to be completely fair, there is some dispersion in the size at which the division actually occurs. I mean, these systems are noisy, and they're not deterministic. That this kind of a model, along with, as I said a moment ago, the stochastic Hinshelwood, gives us the distribution function that I showed before. And we can now also, because it's a little bit hard to think about master equations, we can reduce the master equation into sort of the equivalent Langevin form. Okay, so that's basically shown here. I'm just repeating the same thing. So the equation of motion for the size of the cell then has a, if you will, a driven term as well as a diffusive term. And so one thing that you should note here is that the size dependence of the noise goes as a square root. So for those of you who like finance and you invested in the market, and especially around 2008, most people believe something called the Black-Scholes equation. So I have the distinction of, despite the fact that two Nobel Prizes in econ went to U of Chicago this year, both Black and Scholes had associations with Chicago. One was a student and one was sort of a student of a student. And they based their work on essentially what was this year's Nobel Prize, which is efficient market theory. So it was essentially a Markovian Langevin equation, and the scaling of their noise function went linearly with the size, not square root with the size. Okay, nevertheless, they underestimated the growth in the noise in the markets, and of course, bubbles and crashes ensue. Okay, so, you know, back to biology, which is easier than finance. Back to our equation of motion. From, as I just said a moment ago, you know, the Black Scholes looks all the same except for this term being different. All right, that's an aside. We can do something, again, a prediction from this Hinshelwood behavior as to basically the square of something called the coefficient of variation. This is basically the variance divided by the square of the mean of the size. It has a proportionality term. I'll explain that a bit more in a moment. If we plot that versus lab time over kind of a scale, that is the division time, that we're predicting is going to be a straight line with the slope. So here's the data, and again, there's color coding for the points. So again, our scaling collapse behavior because of this normalization that occurs here. And we see that this number, the slope here, is rather a small number. Well, this is basically telling us the following, that I called the rate constant the, if you will, the non-equilibrium drive in the system, and I'm going to call this the noise. So this system is strongly driven. It's way out of equilibrium. You know, this ratio of what is the magnitude of the noise to the drive term is indeed very small. So we're way the heck out of equilibrium. This is one of the reasons we can kind of use this Langevin treatment. So, okay, so, I guess I have this question to ask myself. Not that I know the answer, but, you know, maybe this is an answer. Why is the system designed in such a way? Why is it so far out of equilibrium? Well, if we look back, maybe I can do it better with a distribution. If we look back at the distribution division times, for example, not the cell size, or here cell size, and we see that the distribution is, you know, nearly around 1 because it's scaled. And essentially there's no probability that the cells would ever shrink in size. So despite the fact that for the aficionados we have Gaussian random noise and Langevin equation, it doesn't really matter. In fact, the cells never shrink in size unless they're sick. Okay, so being driven out of equilibrium seems like, well, you know, that would convey robustness. That is, it's not going to be so sensitive to the environment. But what's really interesting in what I said, and let me impress it upon you, is that this is the same behavior at all temperatures. And it turns out it's the same behavior for most nutrient conditions that we've exposed these cells to. That I didn't expect. So, I didn't even expect uremia. There are many surprises to me in this whole study. Okay, so you ought to be surprised by this. You know, the bacteria, some of them that live inside of us, like E. coli, are well adapted to 37 or whatever our canonical body temperature is, and rich nutrient conditions. And you take the organism out of those conditions and even vary it systematically, it's not going to have the scaling behavior at all. So this organism that lives out in the real world under poor nutrient conditions, somehow, my feeling is, it somehow found an optimum, some cost-benefit analysis between how much energy does it have to consume to maintain itself in this driven way of life versus what is the intrinsic noise that occurs, the stochasticity that's arising from basically temperature. Okay, so I found this pretty interesting, but it, you know, becomes very philosophical. Okay, all right, now back to the experimental details. So we have, as I said, very good precision in the determination of the cell size, but we can go a little bit further than that, which is to say, you know, what actually is the shape of the growing and ultimately dividing cell? And we can do that up to a point. So we're not doing any super resolution microscopy. We're not doing electron microscopy. So there are limits on our spatial resolution. So what we're going to look at is basically with some color coding here associated with the curvature, local curvature of the growing cell. All right, so if we first look at the following feature, that is, when the cell is about to divide, there's a mother, And we can create a ratio, for example, of, just again, for a dimensionless parameter, how wide is it at its max value versus what is the min value that it's going to have? And the min is always going to occur at what will become the division plane, so the point of constriction on this. And we see that we have this curve, and for the different temperature data, that they're all behaving more or less the same in the shaded region around here is basically variance. Okay, so the curve seems to be rather sort of monotonic up to the point of maybe somewhere around 0.85 or 0.9, and that simply has to do with the finite spatial resolution in our microscope. You know, we lose information about curvature because in the electron microscopy image of these kinds of cells, this obviously pinches off to a point and we can't resolve a point. Okay, so I'm just going to think about, well, what's happening for the growth behavior up to through most of this curve? So that's shown here. Some of the colors don't show up so well. So there are two curves on here. It's basically the same kind of data at some given temperature. We have a blue curve and a red curve, and red is exponential, and blue is a Hill function. So a Hill function is something that talks about cooperativity in biochemistry or allosteric effects. Mechanistically, what happens in order to have pinch-off here is that a biopolymer is basically formed of a protein called FTSZ, and it's basically a molecular motor of sorts that will consume ATP or GTP and constrict, that is literally squish down the cell wall and pinch off the two cells. So what we think we're looking at, I mean, we haven't really proven this, so I'm just saying that from these top-down experiments, we can see a measure of the evolution of size parameters of the organism, not just the total area, but now getting into a little more detail on the shape and of the organism. And from that, we can deduce basically there's a Hill-like function, and it has some degree of sort of allosteric or cooperativity that occurs. Okay, we've also very recently, and I won't dwell on this, it gets extremely complicated, and so I just want to give highlights. We also recently have been thinking about simulations for, you know, what kind of constriction, the dynamics of cell wall constriction, and whether there are other features that will emerge, which I didn't emphasize before. But if, for example, we have an equation of motion, which is basically parameterizing the rate of strain versus some energy functional, and if we say that the energy functional is associated with basically the turgor pressure, that is the internal pressure of the bacterium, and a cell wall tension, and the surface area of the cell wall, plus then this other term of E cytoskeleton, which is way down at the bottom. This is basically created by way of three explicit proteins. MREB, for those of you who might know about E. coli or follow that sort of work, is a helical protein that basically that converts a ostensibly balloon that would have a spherical shape into a cylinder. The unique thing about Colobacter crescentis is it has a protein called CRES, which seems to only bind along one face of the organism, and it gives rise to the crescent shape. And the FTSZ I mentioned already is being the motor protein that creates the division. So what we looked at in these simulations is that there's a bit of a change in parameterization in units. But if instead of thinking about absolute length, we think about an arc length, that is an angular variable, and what is the width parametric in this angular variable as a function of angle, we see that when the cell is rather short, let's say this dotted line here, we have a little bit of invagination that occurs because the FTSZ is pulling on it. This representation is not showing the crust so well, but that's a more subtle point. But if we make the cell a bit longer, and a bit longer yet in terms of this arc, then what we see is not just the beginning of the pinch-off for the division, but we see a secondary modulation that occurs which this is now in the 2B mother cell. And this curvature is reflecting the signature of this crest protein, which gives rise to the crescent shape of the whole organism. So we're now starting to chase down the question of the cart and the horse. Is this a continuum mechanics problem on this organism where this modulation is begetting higher order modulation somewhere along the shape of the cell, and then the protein binds, or is it more symbiotic? In other words, the protein is binding as we're deforming the cell wall. And so we're enhancing the binding affinity because of a continuum mechanics problem. Okay, so I don't know the answer to that yet. We have to do fluorescence microscopy measurements, but those are yet to be done. Okay, so I'm going to use this slide as a transition point. I haven't yet used up all my time, but I have to hurry. That I told you something about this stochastic Hinshelwood model at steady state. And indeed, in our mathematical treatment of the stochastic Hinshelwood model, we didn't have to limit ourselves to steady state, but we could look at the entire dynamics of how are these cells evolving. These are very strange units, but let's just say this is any generic species inside the cycle. And at steady state, they're all going to be parallel lines to each other because they all grow according to the same rate law. And this is basically just a kind of a scaled unit of time or scaled units of time in terms of the the growth constant. Okay, so at some point, let's say around two of these units of time, we'll call it two cell cycles, the system operates in steady state. And the really amazing thing is, of course, when the cell divides, it distributes proteins and internal content about in proportion to what it had in the connected system. And so upon division, the cells immediately are already in steady state growth. And so the way, if we're going to learn anything about transient behavior and further tests of this model, what we have to start to do is perturb the growth behavior and get onto some initial condition. Okay, so I'll give you a little bit of a flavor for that as a motivation, but also really how does what I'm about to tell you, in my opinion, fit into the scheme of genomics, which is by far the best way to get a great deal of information about biochemical reaction networks. So you've probably seen, maybe even in physics today, things like this, which are gene chip arrays, where one can enumerate what is the protein I'm looking at, and maybe even something about, in a coarse-grained way, how is that expression level changing with time. I can then, if I know the identity of these species, I can then identify the gene names. Maybe I can associate them with particular functions or processes, and this you don't have to be able to understand or see. Of course, I can translate that then into, and this is a canonical approach, into a system of coupled ordinary differential equations. Okay, so this in my vocabulary gives us a connectivity map or maybe a structural topology of the biochemical reaction network. And the way I think about this, what I'm going to tell you about in a moment, is by way of perturbations, is to create a spectroscopy that is a perturbation, a response, which is, and I'll show you, I hope I demonstrate this effectively, a functional topology of the network. So this is back to how does our electrical circuit analogy work. Okay, so this is a schematic and overview. So we're going to have pulsatile perturbations. This is a small molecule, xylose, whose concentration we're changing. This interacts with the CTRA protein I mentioned in the introduction. We can then measure a response function. So the response function is periodic in the phase of the cell cycle. One means that the cell cycle is done, and then this will repeat itself. This is talking about I can advance cells, make them grow and divide, or I can make them divide sooner. I can delay cells. They'll divide later. And then this kind of information can be basically turned into our own set of coupled differential equations, where, by the way, the coupling function is the entire exercise here. There's a topology question about the degree of the network, and then the coupling function. So there's, at a fundamental level, there's really a vast difference between what goes on here and what we're doing. I'll outline that later. Okay, so probably I should have mentioned these sorts of things first. We think of this as a kind of a limit cycle oscillator, and any kind of a perturbation that we create that is normally the cell wants to just propagate in its limit cycle, if we create a perturbation, that means we start at an initial condition somewhere else. And just by, you know, if you will, gravitational pull, it will evolve to the stable limit cycle. All right, that I said already. Okay, this is the thing, you know, jet lag going to China. Okay, so more interesting thing is something that one of my colleagues at Chicago is doing, is he has a very small three-protein cycle, it's a circadian process, and during, let's say, it normally, I'm sorry, here we're not going to see the color differences at all. He chose very poorly. So one is black and one is like dark blue. So anyway, one of these is the regular unperturbed system, and then we shine light on the system for a little while, and you can see that there's a phase shift that was created. So somehow light changes the ATP-ADP concentration, changes the phosphorylation state on these proteins, changes some of the rate constants, and it gives rise to phase shift, which then begins to oscillate again. So this is sort of the idea of the experiment. You know, can we perturb it, our cell, and then can we shift the phase? This is a very nice book by Pekovsky that illustrates this, and don't think of this as photons, this is chemicals. If we initially have a random distribution of phases, a histogram plot here, perhaps if we pulse this perturbation in some appropriate time configuration, appropriate period, then perhaps we can narrow this distribution, we can create a synchronized state. So that's really the essence of the experiment. Okay, this is a cartoon of the biology. I actually sort of went through this. The experiment, again, is in a microfluidic setup. And we just have two inputs, either low xylose or high xylose, and we'll just toggle between these two. What that, in turn, is going to be doing is changing the timing of the expression of this master regulator protein, CTRA. We can either advance it or we can delay it, and our response function will tell us how much that occurs. Okay, so at the level of a population, that is, if we just consider all the cells together, and to remind you, I'm only going to look at the initial set of cells, so anything else in this case that might have stuck to the surface, we ignore. And so we should have the cell division events as a function of time growing linearly, not exponentially. We're not looking at the daughter cells. And then schematically, after we turn on these xylose pulses, what we see is a staircase behavior that ensues. And so at the level of the population, staircase means is a kind of a signature synchronization. The actual data, more importantly, looks like this, and I can guide you through this, and it's kind of intuitive once maybe I explain it, is what I'm going to do is it should be internal time. This is in units of minutes. And this is a running lab time shown here. So this unit of time is basically the interval just before the pulsations begin. And we're going to do a construction. This is only by eye, so you and I can visualize something instead of a random collection of points. The construction is this diagonal, the slope 1, so that the cells that divide soonest are here, the cells that divide latest in that interval are up here, and then they will maintain that horizontal registration throughout the experiment. Okay, so if that's our, if you will, initial condition, then if we propagate backwards in time, then what we see is a diagonal persists, but it gets noisy, it gets fuzzy. And so, yeah, that should invoke the idea of diffusion, so like a Langevin equation. If we go forward in time where we've done now this pulsing of a small molecule and we're basically doing work on the system, you can see that what happens is that we rotate the distribution into the vertical. This is what gives rise to the staircase-like behavior. This is basically just the integral of these points. And there's a little bit of squeezing that occurs also, and I could discuss that if there are questions about it. That is, the cells tend to be herded between these pulses. Okay, so indeed we can change from some initial state, non-equilibrium steady state, to some final non-equilibrium steady state where the metric is basically the degree of synchronization. So that we can quantify here via something which is basically a Shannon entropy type definition. And this simply is a simple function that goes between the limits of 0 and 1. 0 means that all phases of the cell cycle and the distribution are equally probable, versus at 1, it's a fully synchronized ensemble. So if we plot that as a metric, and we'll just focus on this red curve here, that we start at low synchronization, in principle no synchronization, and asymptotically go to some level. This is our transition between non-equilibrium steady states. But now, of course, we have much more information, although we haven't really used it yet, of the individual cells. How do they go from unsynchronized to synchronized? So first, response function. So this is a sort of standard definition that was, I think, first coined by Art Winifree. If we take the period of division in the cell cycle, before perturbation, and then if we have one of these perturbing pulses occur and we measure the next period of division, and if that's advanced, for example, then we can construct this function of the change in the phase according to the scaling unit here, and that tells us whether the cells are advanced in time divide sooner or the cells are delayed in time divide later. So our response function, as I told you. Okay, so one of the reasons we chose this system is that this is a different rendition, but it has more words on it and less symbols, is we chose this CTRA protein and we chose this organism because others had already published very molecularly detailed models of the biochemical reaction network associated with the cell cycle. That allows us to do simulations. And so I'll show that on the next slide. But keep in mind one thing. The CTRA, from their paper, they decided CTRA is obligate. And this is equivalent, in my mind, to saying this is the same kind of a machine as a watch. So the watch I showed on my second slide. Everything is completely synchronized and linked to everything else. So what we ended up doing in this locked gear kind of a perspective is the CTRA is what we're perturbing. Cell division is what we're measuring. So we're looking at how do these two processes interact with each other. This is just cartoon to say here's the network. And here in green is the response function we calculate versus the polynomial fit to what I showed a moment ago, what we measure in experiment. It doesn't work at all. So this has gotten me into big trouble, again, problems with reviewers, that I didn't go into this to disprove anything. I went into it because I thought this is like well established. I know the hydrogen atom. Well, at least they don't know the hydrogen atom. So this is sort of showing it. And there's nothing we could do for manipulating this network in terms of rate constants to improve this. This is the best we could get. So we would have to break the network in some way, but that's not trivial. So rather, we took the other approach, and this is partially motivated by something that Fred Cross at Rockefeller had done in the case of yeast, which is he also has the idea of a driving engine and sub-processes that are somehow interacting in a soft manner with the driving engine. So our view is the following, is that we have our cell cycle engine, which is basically CTRA process. We have cell division occurring. And these are two differential equations, and we're going to devise the coupling function that connects these two things together. So that's basically here. From a previous paper that we had published in 2010, we knew what the response function was for one of these processes. And now this is our entire theory. So now we have a second differential equation, which is associated with the division oscillator. And then we have this coupling function I was just mentioning. So now this red curve through the data points is from theory, not from not just polynomial fitting. It has some details in it, like these kinks, but I can't really go into that. And what we see is the coupling function looks the following. If this were a deterministic machine, this coupling would be uniform across all cell phases or differential phases, so engine versus division oscillator. And we see it's totally asymmetrical. It's more like a diode. So I'll translate this into English. Weak coupling in this regime, it basically means that the division oscillator, that is the division process, is lagging behind all internal processes. So the cell is free to go. It can divide whenever it wants. We don't have to do anything to it, or the engine doesn't do anything to it. On the other hand, if division has gotten ahead of the internal processes, is like DNA replication, that's bad. The progeny are going to be impaired or dead, and nobody wants that. So this is basically saying that let's put on the brakes and hold back the division process. And so we get this strong nonlinearity in this coupling function. This has other nice attributes, like it filters noise. So all upstream noise, a lot of upstream noise that is tenfold gets reduced in this behavior. We also tested the idea of linear response, and that was to change the magnitude of the perturbation, in this case the duration of it. And we could use all the parameters from this except for change in duration, and we get, again, basic parameterless agreement with the experimental data for the response function. So we think that we have a linear response behavior as well. Okay, if we want to put molecular players on it, we can start to do that. But I think I'll stop at this slide and use this to summarize and tie two of these ideas together. So basically what I'm telling you is instead of this detailed network that somehow the authors of this network said collapses onto a topology of churn number one, that is a coffee cup with one handle on it, what we have we're only representing two processes, this engine and division. There are many other processes as well that are not illustrated here, but we think that these are all functioning semi-autonomously. And why not? This is a much nicer design principle than having a machine where everything has to work precisely together. Rather, this just has to work, and this has to work, and at some point they have to talk to each other and make sure that, you know, they got the relative timing of things right. But beyond that, there's no need for everything to be an interlocked machine with mesh gears. The Hinshelwood part of this is completely a figment of my imagination, but basically it's associated with metabolism. We know that from other experiments I'm not going to have time to tell you about. So it has something to do with also driving this entire engine forward. So it's really a different story, but basically the drive for this entire cell cycle process is coming from sort of the metabolic processes that are associated with the Hinshelwood that I told you about in the first part of my presentation. There's much more that can be learned from these pulsatile type of experiments that my time is up and I won't dwell on at this point, but let me just show you one and then I'll conclude, is that if we do metabolic pulsing, so now white, gray is basically alternating between rich medium and a minimal medium, we can see that there are almost instantaneous switches at each of these junctions between the growth law, and it's toggling, it's responding very rapidly to the change in the medium. And here we also see a reduced productivity, basically the overall growth behavior is slowing down, so we are senescing, we are aging the cells from this standpoint by stressing them a little bit. So under these kinds of conditions, we can also learn about these pathways. Okay, so I probably dwelled on all these things way too long already. I think we brought a nice new picture to light and did this now in the stochastic fashion. I think this has sort of generality beyond just the organism at hand. This whole study in the first part of the talk really tells us something about sort of an optimization because of the robustness against or the scaling behavior with respect to environmental conditions like temperature. And the perturbation experiments are really going to be a route to teasing all this apart. Okay, so if that's abstract, then, this is what matters, and they do. And then this is my group who did the work, Ihan Lin, who's now postdocing with Mike Elowitz at Caltech, and Charlie Wright and Sri are shown here. Stas, who did some of the theory, is shown here, and thank you very much for your attention.